Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, much-loved comedian Sharparag Khosandi shares her rollercoaster ride of a life shaped by undiagnosed attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Khosandi discusses her latest publication, Scatterbrain, and shares what it's really like to live a life out of control. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, Khosandi shares her heartbreaking and hilarious journey of self-discovery.
Hi, I'm being openly ADHD and bringing my dog. This is Jamie.
Well, I think Jamie may steal the show. Hello, I'm Yvette Huddleston, and I'm delighted to be here to speak to Sharparag Khosandi this evening. So we will be chatting for about 45 minutes or so, and then we're going to open up to questions from you. There'll be a couple of roving mics to come and find you if you'd like to ask a question to Sharparag. So let's make a start. Sharparag Khosandi is a much-loved stand-up comedian and author. She burst into the higher levels of the British comedy scene in 2006 with her hit Edinburgh show Asylum Speaker. And in the years since, she's proved herself to be one of the UK's finest comedians. She's appeared on numerous TV and radio shows, including Have I Got News For You?, Just a Minute, 8 out of 10 Cats, Live at the Apollo, The Graham Norton Show, Mop the Week, Question Time, and I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. We may come back to that later, or we may not. Her first book, her 2009 memoir, A Beginner's Guide to Acting English, which told the story of how she and her family were forced to flee Iran in the late 1970s when Shapi was just a little girl, after the upheaval of the revolution there. That book received much deserved acclaim. She's also the author of two works of fiction, the coming-of-age novel Nina Is Okay. Nina Is Not Okay.
She wasn't okay.
Which was published in 2016, and Kissing Emma, published in 2021, which is inspired by the life of Lord Nelson's mistress, Emma Hamilton. Last year, saw the publication of her latest book, Scatterbrain, which is obviously what we'll be talking about this evening, in which she candidly shares her experience of having lived most of her life with undiagnosed ADHD. And she describes her fairly recent diagnosis when she was in her late 40s as feeling like the lights had been turned off after a lifetime in the dark. So welcome, Shapi. Thank you for coming to chat to us. So can we start where you actually start in the book, which is an incident that prompted you to begin to work towards getting that diagnosis, which was...
I will start by that. And also it's weirdly connected to how I got here this evening from my hotel, because, like, I don't know how you got here, but I had to leapfrog over some fences, climb some scaffolding, and just follow locals who know where they're going. And before my diagnosis and before I had knew I had ADHD, something like that would have meant I'd end up in tears and trampling around going, for fuck's sake, like that. And that emotional dysregulation was a huge, huge part of how my brain works, inability to regulate my emotions. So I had tantrums for far longer than either of my children did. And they witnessed my tantrums, like being late for, I made us late for my son's piano lesson once. And I'm just raging, like, we didn't have piano lessons when I was a kid. You're so spoiled. And it was me that made us late. And then it was just too late to go, like, let's just go home. And then I said to my son, I don't want you to think that my behaviour is normal. And he said, no, don't worry, I don't. And the thing was that I start there in my book because before lockdown, I had an army helping me to look after my children. You know, my mum and dad live nearby. My ex-husband lives nearby. I live in a nest of feathers with the most incredible neighbours and community. So I never really felt like a single mum, though I am, in the way that I did in lockdown when everything was on me. And it was at a time, the lockdown one, when we still, you know, weren't sure of the effect of COVID on children. And every time I went out my house, I felt like I was risking their lives. And it was very stressful.
Yeah, and presumably you were homeschooling as well. Or trying.
I mean, homeschooling is a kind way to put it, I think. The stress of that was unreal because I was also writing Kissing Emma. Looking back, I should have thought, now is not the time to write a book. Have your money back, publishers. I can't write. But I didn't. I didn't manage myself the way I manage myself now. Yeah. I couldn't verbalise what I need even to myself. So I went out. I found a box of dairy milk chocolate in the supermarket. There was hardly any chocolate in our supermarkets. And I came home and my children squabbled over how to open the box. And it just went. And I lost my temper like that over this box of chocolate. And I hurled it across the kitchen. Chocolates went everywhere. I have a golden retriever. And I also had a rescue dog called Benji, which I got in lockdown, a shepherd crossed with a pit bull. So that, I think that rescue dog was also a symptom of my ADHD, just trying to create more chaos. And luckily, my lovely neighbours, Valerie and Valerie, took him in the end. But these two dogs went for the chocolate, poisonous.
Yeah.
My kids are rescuing, you know, like saving, not saving the chocolates, but saving the dogs from the chocolate. And I just looked at the scene and I just thought, this is not right. I'm the adult here. These children should not be having to deal with me. My daughter was six. So I just went out in my socks to my best friend's garden and cried. And then I got back home and I Googled psychotherapist ADHD and up popped my therapist, Ian, who I start off the book with a quote from Ian because he too is ADHD. Game changer. He absolutely changed my life.
And how long did that take? So it was sort of shortly after that incident then. That does sound as though that was completely a kind of, you know, that sort of prompted action.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought my kids cannot suffer like that. They, in lockdown, at any time, they should not have an adult screaming at them. And that was... And I was seeing my therapist for a really short time. And I think after about a month, both my children said, you never shout anymore. Because I used to shout because I was stressed. And I'm not a shouty person. I'm not, like when I was 10, I was not shouty.
So it's a kind of accumulation, isn't it? Yes. And then, and then it's something just goes and you can't.
Yeah, it changed our lives, me getting therapy specifically to understand ADHD. Yeah.
Right, because it's very specialised therapy that focuses on how to understand it yourself. And then work on.
Well, it helped that he had ADHD and he'd raised two adopted children who had ADHD. And he told me things that I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, you're right. Like just... getting dates wrong, times wrong, how it's useless me having a diary on a, what are they called, phone. Because my brain just doesn't work in that way where I can just quickly check my phone and put it down. I'll quickly check my phone to know where, and I'll get the time completely wrong. I'll get the place completely wrong. And then it's not the ADHD itself that is a problem. It's not knowing that you have it. That's the problem.
Yeah, which is obviously, as you say, you lived most of your life up to that point, not knowing. So what? Soon after that, you started speaking about it kind of publicly, I think, didn't you, on social media. How did it feel speaking about it for the first time? And were you sort of apprehensive in any way?
Well... see, I knew there was something that I couldn't help. So I was diagnosed with PTSD, OCD, complex anxiety, all of this sort of stuff, bulimia, you know, I was a binge drinker, all of that. And I used to know there was something. So the tantrums that I talk about would only ever happen with family and boyfriends, like immediate family and boyfriends and random strangers on the bus. It was, you know, like, yeah.
If someone's playing their music too loud.
Music out loud, rude to me. So that rejection sensitivity, this is a thing I didn't know about, rejection sensitivity dysmorphia or something. Mm-hmm. And when that was explained to me, it made sense because I could hear people laughing on the other side of the underground train when I was younger. And I'd go, they're laughing at me, they're laughing at me, they're laughing mm-hmm. at me. Or like I'd walk into, you know, a green room and somebody would not be very friendly. And instead of, like, now I think, oh, they're in their own world. They've got stuff going on. They want me dead. And those things just cause so much ruminations of negativity and anxiety. And I realized that I can manage that. And those things are, anxiety is something that's separate to me. I didn't know my anxiety was separate to me. Someone put it beautifully, how a dog doesn't know it's a dog. You don't know you're a dog. You're a dog. I didn't know I could be anything other than this sort of, but I masked it, I hid it. I was always like, sweetness and light and get on with everybody. And I'm a celebrity. That really, I wonder how that would have been if I'd known about my ADHD then, because in there I was super masking. I would not let anything get to me. I'd just be like, oh, that's fine, that's fine, you've stolen my bed, that's fine.
I'm very polite. And
terribly polite because I did not know how to be angry safely. So I thought, I can't lose my shit because I will really lose my shit. I never trusted speaking my true feelings and what I was thinking about something for fear that I turn into the Incredible Hulk.
So once you did start speaking about it publicly, what kind of response did you get?
It was wild what happened, because I thought I'll post a thing up saying, oh, I've got ADHD. And I thought I'd get a couple of people going, oh God, everyone's got something. Everyone's got a label. Didn't happen. I got absolutely inundated. My direct messages, because I said, if anyone wants to talk about it, or flooded. And literally all I was doing all day was answering direct messages and reading people's stories and you know, having ADHD, I really did devote a lot of time to doing that. It was so upsetting because a lot of people in my generation who grew up in the, you know, 70s and 80s where ADHD was, or ADD as they called it, was something like naughty little boys had that went around setting off fire alarms. But the hyperactivity in women in particular can be very quiet.
Yes.
Very, very quiet. So you would just ruminate and just be hyperactive, but in your own body.
It wasn't actually noticeable to other people.
Not noticeable at all. Yeah. And the way I masked it, and so many people talked about other ways they masked it at school. I went to like a big comprehensive school where if you had a middle-class accent, you were dead. Like you got your head kicked in. But that was preferable to being caught out by the teachers by not doing my homework, because my terror was that I'd be put in the learning support class because there was such a stigma to have learning support needs back then, right? And so I started to speak like this at school because I'd say, I'm so sorry, miss, I haven't done my homework, and I learned that a middle-class accent meant that you got away with murder. And we see that at school and we see that in politics.
Everywhere.
Yes. And so I had no friends, but I also didn't get in trouble for not doing my homework. Yeah. And I also really didn't get the education that I could have done.
You spend quite a bit of time, and I understand, I completely understand why, because you were very bright, you were good at French and English and sociology and other things, but you found it very difficult to complete homework, even in subjects that you were interested in. And so it felt to you, I mean, possibly not at the time, but certainly in retrospect, as though the system had let you down.
You know what? It absolutely did. And I really love the fact that you said I talk a lot about school, because the publishers eventually said to me, Shappy, could you leave high school now? Because the whole book was just about school. Because that was the bit that really harmed me and hurt me and scuppered my chances of being the geek that I wanted to be. And the shaming of children who are not able to fit in a box at school. There are some kids that should be up a tree reading. Mm. It just doesn't work for them, right? And when I was at school, I was really good at English and French and sociology. Like, there was a, I mean, how can you not be interested in sociology? We learned about a girl in Portugal that was raised in a chicken coop. I mean, there's no way, even with the most rampant ADHD, you could not be really interested in that. But other classes that I wasn't interested in, and it's not a, oh, it can be so misconstrued as an arrogance or laziness, but if I'm not interested in something, it's not even like I, it's like a this black curtain comes down in my head. There's no way out if I'm not interested. And somebody can teach it to me in an interesting way, that there I have a hope. But in a class of 30, with a math teacher going, wah, 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 did everybody get that? I didn't get it. Which bit didn't you get? Mm. Bit where I was forced to be here. Yeah. Like I, and then in other classes, I would do well. And they'd go, well, you know, if you gave your maths and science as much a focus as you do your English, then you wouldn't be in this mess. So you were blamed for it.
Yeah.
And that really is so frustrating as a child, because you believe it. I'd be like, okay, I'll just focus. Okay, physics, he's speaking English, not Mandarin. It was really, really tough being told that it was my fault.
And that would be exacerbated by the hypersensitivity, which, you know, made you terrified of being told off.
So yeah.
It kind of then becomes, you know, a really huge thing.
So then you can't speak. You can't say what's wrong. You can't, because you don't know yourself. You've been taught that it's you that's the problem.
You did get some kind of closure at some point, though. There's a really lovely story that, you know, you sort of bumped into just by chance, actually, one of your old teachers.
I did.
Mr. Houlihan, it's not his real name, but...
That's not his real name, no.
His real name's Mr. Wheel. Okay. I wasn't trying to, you know, reveal. But, yeah.
No, so he was our PE teacher. So at my school, there was a lot of black kids and Asian kids and white kids, pretty much third. And on the surface, it looked like a proper melting pot. But even as a child, I saw how back in the 80s at that school, which has since been open about past institutionalized racism, I saw how black boys in particular were written off. And I saw that at school. And again, how helpless to be a kid and to hear a teacher use the N-word in a class where there was one white girl, and that was my best mate. She's half Turkish. And none of us were empowered enough to say anything. So then we weren't empowered enough to talk about divergence, right? And then I read quite a few interviews with the artist and film producer, Steve McQueen. And he talked about his school and how he was written off as a black boy. And I went, it sounds just like my school. And I looked him up, and sure enough, yeah, it was. He was in the year above me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh. So I thought that's when I started thinking it wasn't just me. And I was at this restaurant in the Isle of Wight. And this man turned round and said, Shaparak, do you remember me? And I instantly went, Mr. Whelan stroke Houlihan. And I said, that school fucked me up. And he said, I know. Would you like to have a cup of tea when we're back in London? I said, yes, please. And we had a cup of tea. We didn't. We had a beer. And he told me how aware he was. He was always cool. He was a good one. he was aware that he wasn't empowered as a 25-year-old young student to do anything about what was going on. And then he said to me, he goes, I've read about your ADHD and stuff that you've talked about at your school days. And he said, I want you to know that you didn't fail at school because you've got ADHD or because your parents were, you know, first generation immigrants and couldn't navigate the system. That's another thing I used to say. My parents couldn't navigate the system. He said, you failed because we failed you. That was so wonderful. He gave me a gift,
yeah.
Because that was validation that I needed from that school.
Mm.
And it really helped me to move on. And I went to visit the school and everything.
Yeah.
It's lovely now. Now their learning support group classrooms are in what they call the Goldfish Bowl. It's right in the middle of the playground. It's made of glass. It's the most beautiful building. People come and go. There is zero shame. Whereas when I went there, it was like hidden away, tucked under. Mm. I think it was just a cupboard under the stairs. So yeah, things have changed.
So that was a really important
huge
thing for you. So at what point after you sort of received your diagnosis and then you got that kind of response from people, did you decide that you wanted to write a book about it?
Well, because people kept asking me questions and I found myself just writing really long direct messages on Instagram and Twitter, and I just thought, I'm just going to write a book and it's really helped people, and it's been the best thing I've done with everything I've done. Because it's, the young woman came up to me the other day in Waterloo and she went, are you Shappy Core Sandy? And I was like, oh, what horror does she know me from? Does she know me from I'm a Celebrity? Does she know me on from MasterChef or another Dave Repeat? She goes, I read Scatterbrain and it was like my life in the pages, and it's made me realise that I need to investigate and, you know, perhaps get a diagnosis. And yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, it's incredibly generous, Shappy. I mean, it's, you know, because it's very, very honest and open. And that's great. And you're helping lots of people, which is brilliant. Did it help you writing that?
Yeah.
Was there some kind of cathartic?
It did. Yeah, it really helped me. It feels like I'm out. Like there's all these things about me that I thought was so weird, and people think I'm a weirdo, and always terrified of getting something wrong, you know, and being so dysregulated in my emotions, crying really easily, just in every way you can imagine it's affected. It's helped me to write it and go over the things, particularly about parenting.
Mm.
Because, you know, if I could change one thing in my life, it would be get help earlier to have been more emotionally regulated with my big boy, mm. My son, who's 16. My daughter's 11. So, and the huge thing was when I was writing it, really seeing the extent of my bulimia and binge drinking. And once I got help for ADHD, they disappeared. And
yeah.
For years and years, I sat in, I mean, they're brilliant. They're brilliant 12-step programs.
Yeah. That was for the bulimia.
Yeah. But for me, alcohol used to make me feel normal.
Mm.
You know, I used to drink to quieten myself down. And I was never like a bad drunk. Like you never saw me, especially like in my older years, like it was never, you'd never go, oh my God, she made a show of herself. I was just like normal. Mm. And the bulimia was huge. Like it took away this thing that I have lived with for all my life since I was about 14. I was like, I can't even find the words. Well, I did find the words.
Well, yeah, it's very powerful because it's like a lifting, you know, because there's so much shame and guilt associated with all those things that you mentioned.
And don't get me wrong, sometimes like it still happens, but it doesn't, there's no shame around it anymore. And I go, okay, what's gone wrong? I haven't been for a run. I haven't taken my pills. I don't think that pills are the be all. I'm so careful to talk about medication because I really get sad when people say, I think I've got ADHD, but I'm on the waiting list for 5 years to get the pills. Mm. I'm like, okay, have you had therapy? What have you read about it? Nothing. Okay.
you know, but for me, the pills really help the food compulsion.
Yeah.
But if I don't have the pills, nature. You know, if I could, and I know when I'm older, when my kids are bored of me, I will go and live in the countryside, because it really makes a difference to be in nature and not have the hustle and bustle.
Yeah, and exercise, as you say.
Exercise is critical.
Yes.
Critical, yeah. Breathing. Who knew? Breathing's important.
Yes. I think we all forget about that.
I didn't breathe for 48 years. In sleep. Wow.
So I'd like to, let's talk a little bit about your comedy career, really, and also the sort of connections and the kind of plus side of having ADHD and the downside of it. So, I mean, there does seem to be a higher number of people with ADHD who are in the creative industries, and particularly in stand-up comedy. Why do you think that is?
Because we're all bonkers. There's a lot of brains in stand-up as well. I think there are lots of reasons. So the biggest myth about ADHD, I don't like the whole attention deficit, because we have so much focus, but we can't direct it on anything other than what we are thoroughly enjoying. And I think that you can be the funniest person in the world, the most curious person in the world, but if you don't have the focus in that arena to make it, then you'll go and do a sensible job instead that's got more security, I think. And also, I think that for me, when I left university, I did go to university, I couldn't fill in forms. I still can't fill in forms. So I was a cleaner and a life model, because they were jobs that I could do and be in my own head. I mean, I've cried. I worked in an office and they asked me to fax something and I couldn't work it out. Mm. And so I just cried and I felt so stupid all the time in front of a computer. Sorry, I just can't navigate this. And so I feel really stupid. But jobs where, even in lockdown, when people were doing stuff on YouTube and they were becoming influencers and doing comedy on Instagram and TikTok and all that, and they were like, people were like, oh, well, we just have to learn how to do that. I was like, I'm not. That's not live. Like, live makes me feel focused. But in my own house, I might as well be, like, I genuinely was thinking I would train to be a plasterer before I became a TikToker.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I love DIY. I'm quite good at plastering, thank you. Because you can listen to the radio, you can listen to podcasts, and you can be in your head and you're doing a physical, manual task. Mm. And so your head can fly away. So with stand-up, a lot of us are divergent, because here on stage is where we feel utterly focused. And also a huge number of people who are self-employed have ADHD. I think Richard Branson has it. And also a massive amount of people in prison have ADHD. And this is a huge thing, that without the parental scout, when I think how difficult things were for me as a teenager, if I hadn't had the parental scaffolding, all of the privileges of, you know, that I have with the parents that I have, then I can totally see why you would lose your shit at a bus stop and punch someone up in prison. And that is a really important thing for me. I'm actually training to be a psychotherapist, and my focus, my dream, is to be able to work with offenders.
Right.
Which is weirdly what I did when I was very, very young. I worked in, I did voluntary projects in young offenders in those halfway houses.
Yeah.
But then showbiz. But it was the most incredible thing I'd ever done. And
that's interesting that it's taking you down that route as well.
Yeah.
Which is the...
Because the thing is that I love stand-up. I really love it, but I don't need it the way I used to.
Right, that's interesting.
I don't need it, and other things nourish me.
Yeah. Because you talk about how it was like a dopamine hit. That's the thing, and it's the risk-taking, which is a big part of when you have ADHD.
You know, stand-up...
Chasing that.
And snowboarders.
Right.
We're the same animal. A lot of people sort of think stand-ups are under the same umbrella as actors. We're not. We're like, it's an extreme sport. It's a craft and an art, not high art. but it's an art and it's brilliant. But now that I don't need it as much, I actually spend so much more time finessing my material and enjoying the creativity of it, whereas before it was like shooting up for me.
Well, sometimes you say you went on stage without having even written any material and you just wing it. That sounds terrifying.
I know, it's brilliant. It was like those people that go climbing tall buildings without any gear. I relate to them. I'd never do it, obviously. They're insane. But stand-up was like that for me. But that's also really hurtful because the downs are really down. Like, you fall off. But now I always prepare. So I don't have the falls like I used to. Like, I died at Live at the Apollo. Like, I did Live at the Apollo without preparing because I couldn't. It was too big, too stressful. So I was and my brain couldn't take a breath. To go, you need to work. Well, you don't need to work on it. You need to say to your manager, 3 years in a row, no thank you. That's not, I haven't accumulated the material, but I didn't do that.
Yeah. So you don't, that's the thing now. You can you don't, you know why, how and how things work. And so you make sure that you give yourself the time. And also, one of the things you say is, I've learnt to say no, which is great. That's quite a big thing, isn't it?
You know what I've learnt to say? This has taken me nearly 50 years to say, can I think about that and get back to you? It's amazing. I still mess up. I've still had to cancel a load of gigs that I put in August that I shouldn't have done. But that's okay. I did them in time. And I'm able to be more confident and say I've messed up. Whereas before, I would like fake my own death rather than be honest and say I made a mistake. Yeah.
So you mentioned your parents there a little bit earlier on, and you're very careful to say, you know, that you don't want people to judge your parents for not noticing, because, well, one, it was the 1980s, these kinds of things weren't really talked about, but also they had a lot to deal with themselves.
They did.
So,
yeah. So the symptoms of ADHD, very similar to trauma. And someone said to me, how do you work out what's ADHD, what's trauma? You don't. And I think that the hereditary element of ADHD can also come from trauma. So my father is, I'm not qualified to say this, and I would say this to him as well. He's riddled with ADHD, right? So my father lost his dad when he was 7 at a time where people just thought children forget. And he's a hoarder, and he's got that real ADHD thing of falling asleep. Like, if he was here now, he'd be asleep. He fell asleep during my honorary doctorate graduation. He never stayed awake or even in the room for our nativity plays. Just falls asleep. And I get that. I fell asleep during my business studies exam. Why was that business studies? Anyway, so looking at my behavior, so much of it was hereditary. My dad and I now can talk about his emotional dysregulation. And it was a really big deal when I did a Radio 4 show. They wanted to do a Radio 4 show about decluttering. And my clutter is debilitating. It's not that I'm just messy. I'm not messy. I can spend the entire day tidying up and it will still look like I've just been burgled. So I am tidying up, but I can't do it, right? And so this program said, oh, let's send you some stuff, and if you record a video diary of yourself on day one, and here's a list, and they gave me some forms and pamphlets and tasks every day, and then they sent it all to me, and then about a month later they came to my house and they found all of the things they sent untouched, unopened, in the corner of my living room, right? Are you mad? As if I'm going to open that. And then The ADHD expert that they brought, sorry, the decluttering expert they brought round, had a look at my, I didn't know you're meant to throw away your banking. I had statements from 1995
all in massive piles in my front room. And this brilliant woman, who is still a good friend of mine, she quietly said to me, "Do you have ADHD? I was like, "You are the millionth person to ask me that." And she said that, so we did the program, but then she privately came to help me and she sorted out my things in a way that makes sense to me. And then I got, basically, declutterers came and threw away all of my belongings. I own nothing. It's brilliant. It's the only way. And they are so skilled. They can go through your paperwork. Ones that are trained to work for, like, with ADHD people, they go through their paperwork, they go through your bric-a-brac, your photos, and they do, or they understand that you can't sit with them and do it. They get to know you and they don't throw anything away without your say-so, but they do it in a way that makes sense. Like, this woman came and she looked at, I've got just a stupid amount of books, right? And she's a, you know, big reader, and she was picking off my books and she was going, "You love Miriam Margolyes. Yes. Brilliant book, isn't it? Yes. Should we give it to the charity shop and someone else who loves her can read it? Yes." So just like that, and like, you know, Adrian Mole's diary, you love him. He means a lot to you. He's special. He's your friend. So you keep that. And all of this stuff. And now, like, my books, a fraction, but they all mean something to me. And my point is about my dad is I showed her photos of my dad's office and our garage, and she looked at the photos, and the first thing she said was, "Has your dad suffered a loss at a young age?" I said, "Yes, he lost his dad." And she said, "I can't help him. This is a hoarder, and it only bothers you and your mother. It doesn't bother him. He needs this.
It makes him feel safe, probably.
It makes him feel safe. Yeah. He can't throw anything away." So he is, yeah, he is very ADHD, my dad. ADHD trauma passed on to me, and hopefully I'm greying it out for my children.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, was it because there's some quite painful memories that you sort of talk about in the book. How difficult was that to sort of revisit those, and obviously with your parents and your brother? You've got an older brother.
I do. You know, the difficulty is that my dad, is wonderful. He's still around with me and he is 80 something and he is a little flippity gibbet and he's done a lot of work on himself. So I had to show him and my brother what I'd written. And my dad was extremely generous in letting me write what I did write about him. And my brother wrote to me and said, "Shat, thanks for holding back so much."
Right.
Because I really do hold back. And I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who has experience of a parent who can be Jekyll and Hyde. But I had two dads. Mm-hmm. You know, one was the best man in the world that you could take any problem to. But then without any kind of warning, no warning, it would just be rumbles like a thunderstorm. Just...
It's like an explosion.
Horror.
Yeah.
And it would be prolonged. And it was, you know, he would never, you know, it was never physically violent, but it was just this explosion. And then it would go. And then he was back to normal. And it was like the Incredible Hulk. Do you know how I describe it? I think I describe it like this in the book, about turning into a werewolf. Oh my God, he's turning into the wolf. And then when he's back, it's like he doesn't remember it. And you mustn't talk about the damage it caused, because that will upset this lovely person here.
Yeah.
And that's a fucked up way to raise kids, frankly. Yeah. Is that, so excuse my language, I don't know why I think you're going to be very Radio 4 here, but it really did have a huge effect on mine and my brother's brains, because it happened for as long as I remember being alive. And I'm very grateful to have him around still now, to be able to talk about it. We do talk about it now.
Which is great. That's a really good
very
thing.
Very healing.
Come out of it, yes.
It is very, very healing, but it's really hard. It was a tough way to be as a kid, because life was either absolutely brilliant or a waking hell.
Yeah. And it's that fear. It's that kind of walking on eggshells.
And so that's why the emotional dysregulation, it's like, well, of course I'm not going to be able to
tell Amir Khan, and I'm a celebrity that I'm pissed off that he was rude to me, because I'm scared how he might react. I'm scared of how people might react. Yeah. But I'm not consciously thinking that, but that's how I've learned. It's like, if you have a problem with someone, you keep it to yourself, because all hell might break loose if you verbalise how you're feeling.
Right, I'm just looking at the time. We want to make sure that there's enough time for...
That was really personal.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's
not as personal as in that. No. Oh, I can't even look at that book. There was actually a big section of that my part, I can tell you now, I might write it in the future, about sex. I don't know why I'm telling you now, because it's not in the book, that my publisher said, Shappy, this is big. Are you sure you want people? It'll be out there. And I was like, you're right. That's like a different book. But why am I telling you this? Because I've got ADHD. Overshared. There you go.
Well, we may see that book at some point. But have we got any questions? Can we see? Raise the lights a bit. Oh, great. So there's one right at the front here.
Hi, so I also have ADHD, and I agree, I don't like the attention deficit, because I can focus, not on the washing up, but I can sit and read for 14 hours straight and forget to eat. So what would you call it if you could rename it and not call it ADHD?
Ah, good question.
Attention, focus, and hyperactivity, it used to be called hyperkinetic something or other. I like the word kinetic. Mm. Something difference. Mm. I put the word difference there instead of disorder. Because it is an attention deficit in some ways, because you're like, well, no, gone. But then you hope. So I would say attention, something. We'll workshop it together. Maybe. But a difference, I think. I talked to Rory Bremner. Rory Bremner's brilliant on ADHD. And we both agreed it should be, the word difference should be in there rather than disorder.
Thank you. Good question. Did we go somewhere over there?
When you were talking about your school days and you said about you wanted to be a geek, now that you're in a better place and your children are getting older, is this something you want to explore?
Yeah. Like, what's your name? Annette. So I thought I'm doing a 5-year master's in psychotherapy, but after a year of doing it and going, this does not feel very part-time, I found out that I've actually accidentally gone into a full-time 3-year degree course in psychotherapy, because what happened is both my children are really good in school in all their subjects. They love learning. It's a cinch to them. And that was baffling me, because I thought I'd be right, you know, but no, they're not like me at all. And I was like, but I'm their mum, so I must be bright too. And it turns out I am. So I was a geek without portfolio, as I put it in my book. And I am studying psychotherapy and just enjoying it this time around. It's not a bit like stand-up. Like, I enjoy it more now rather than it just be a buzz. So yeah, I'm going to finish my degree in 2 years, and then I'll do my master's, and then who knows, maybe I'll be a real Dr. Shappy.
There you go, the full geek, and get
exciting.
The
thing.
Any other questions?
Hi, my name is Farida. My voice sounds very loud on the microphone.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing today. I know it takes a lot of courage to share your personal stories, for anyone really. I just wanted to share that in terms of my work, there's a lot of work I do around Bradford and specifically in Keighley, and we're doing some work which is very much cross-sector, convening sort of health experts and police and, you know, teachers and all sorts of faith bodies on there as well, and charities. And we're looking to create a health hub which is focused on, you know, on kind of, you know, those sorts of neurodivergent conditions and situations that go unnoticed, and really building trust within communities. And this is, you know, some work that's being piloted across 4 different areas in Bradford. I'd really love it if you were able to give us some time and maybe even support the creation of that hub, and maybe even be, you know, maybe it could be named after you, I don't know. But, you know, well, I think it would be great. Yeah.
If there's a statue, you've got a deal.
Brilliant. I'm sure we could get that commissioned. But well, I think it would be great for you to be involved in something like that, you know, in terms of a kind of legacy from your own kind of lived experience and giving back to the communities here.
Yeah, I mean, I do as much as I can. Yeah, I am accidentally doing a full-time degree as well as a job.
So you've got quite a lot on your plate.
But yeah, I will. Give me a couple of years and I'll be at your service.
Sure.
Thank you. Then this lady here, sorry, would it?
Yeah, I'll try not to overshare as we do as diagnosed ADHD, as late diagnosed as well. And reading your book was also like a validation, because it was my story. Unfortunately, I was diagnosed when my son was 18. So, but therapists, is there any top tips with trying to find a therapist that, you know?
First of all, I really heard what you said, that your son's 18. So I'm guessing...
He's 21 in a month.
So I'm guessing that as a parent, you know, I know. It's really, really hard. But I will say that any age, my dad's 80 and we are healing together. You know, any age you can make reparations, right? The really big problem with psychotherapy is that the whole education system even now works against people with ADHD. Like Turnitin can do one. Moodle, Turnitin, for me, it's like trying to find platform 9 3/4, right? And I've had to feed back to my tutors that if I leave this course, it will be because I can't deal with the admin and it's still not in place, the support. Ah, I'm going to tell them that happened. So I genuinely am horrified at the amount of psychotherapists that don't even know about ADHD. Like my current psychotherapist, I'm having to tell her a lot. Because, sorry, it's really, I've bored myself, but I'll be very quick. When you study psychotherapy, you have to have your personal therapy in the modality that you're studying. So my brilliant ADHD psychotherapist was psychodynamic, but I'm studying Gestalt. So now I have a Gestalt therapist, so I've had to tell her. And it's fine, but that wouldn't have worked for me when I was first diagnosed. I would go on to the British Counselling and Psychotherapy website and in the search box do what I did and write adult ADHD and see what comes up in your area. Loads of people work on Zoom now as well, which is, I think, one of the very few good things that came out of lockdown is that we have learned that Zoom can be as good as face-to-face. So I would search specifically for someone who specializes in ADHD, because then you're not having to explain yourself to someone from scratch. And also, if I may, recommend a book to you by Philippa Perry called The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read and Your Children Will Be Thankful That You Did. It's a really good book to help you. That's all I'll say.
Thank you. There's one question over here.
All right. Thank you for that 45 minutes or a bit longer. I resonated with your story. I've not been diagnosed. I'm an educator. I've lived in 5 different countries, been an educator for 20 years. As I resonated with some of the things that you mentioned, from parenting to schooling to other factors, it doesn't infuse me to go out. Maybe I'm in denial to go get ADHD test. But I want to speak as an educator and what I'm working with currently. And the current generation, it might sound a little bit controversial, but the labelling seems to rescue a lot of children nowadays. So we have a conflict. We have a lot of people talking about building resilience in the generation, so when they get older, they can deal with things, just like you've shared your example. And at the same time, there's more and more labels coming out. And I'm speaking, again, purely as an educator. Some of the best children or young adults that I've worked with somehow, some way, push through that, just like you have, just like I have, I think. And I worry that as they get into adulthood, they'll carry that label, but use it to be rescued, use it in a way that exploits things, but also, more worryingly, create havoc for the generation that comes after as well. And there's a lot of things going on in the world, and I feel personally, as a 46-year-old, there needs to be a bit of a balance. But I just wondered what your thoughts were about the labelling and how it's used to rescue and used to exploit things.
Okay, I will say that for me, the labelling is no different to being labelled short-sighted and needing glasses. And I understand what you're saying, because it's not the first place I've heard this. I think that there is, when you're young, then you do find your tribes. I think that's a natural part of being a young person. But I trust in the human spirit that those kids, when they grow up to be adults, they can see what's serving them and what's not serving them. And for me, whether or not, you know, anyone that, you know, forgets their phone, can't find their phone or leaves it in a taxi from time to time, labelling themselves as ADHD, I kind of feel that's not my concern. My concern is the people who, like you're saying, are battling through and giving the impression that they're doing all right. But what people don't understand is this is something that people with ADHD say a lot. It's like, I have ADHD, I can do anything, but it costs me everything. You're lovely. So that's what I think my focus is on. I personally haven't had experience of feeling that the rescue that you're talking about. I think that people find their own way in however way they find it, and kids aren't deliberately failing. Like, just amongst my own friendship groups, when their child needs extra support, I see it as that. They need extra support in certain areas. I actually am looking forward to a time where we don't have the term neurotypical, because what does that even mean? But I imagine, that's my answer.
Yeah, that's a nice, I'm just looking at the time. We're going to have to wrap up, I'm afraid. But that's a lovely kind of positive looking to the future note to end on, I think, because it's about diversity. We're all different. Yeah. I think that term neurotypical doesn't really.
So just to give you a quick example, I'm sure my daughter won't mind me saying this, but when I see traits of ADHD in my daughter, that is fine. It's fine because I'm her mum and I know how to support her. So she's starting a new high school in September and she already knows it's going to be very strict and they get detentions if they forget their pencil. And I know about her emotional, you know, her rejection sensitivity. And I say to her, you can't fall further than me. I couldn't care less if you forget your pencil. I couldn't care less if you get a detention, right? What matters to me is that you get up every morning and you go to school and you enjoy yourself and you come and tell me bits of your day that didn't work for you, and we will, having someone to talk to is really, really important. I would never say to her, I mean, they're good kids. For example, both of my children, get this for SWOTs. I've always said to them, because when my dad, eventually, when I told him I was being bullied at school when I was 14, he said to me, if you wake up in the morning, you don't want to go to school, you don't have to go to school. And then that made me able to go to school every day. It became my little challenge. And so from when they were tiny, I've always said to them, if you ever wake up in the morning and you get funny knots in your tummy about going to school, you don't have to go. Neither of them have ever taken me up on it, even when I begged them to come to Winter Wonderland on a Monday afternoon. So I hope that makes sense. So I think more than looking at the children, I think we should talk to parents so they have an awareness of how they can support their children and accept their children. Okay, sometimes you zone out in physics. Sometimes that's okay. That's all okay. What's not okay is that you bottling that in and watching TikTok all day at people who are monetizing their ADHD and stuff like that, which I find, I'm hoping there'll be a tipping point with all that.
Yeah,
I'm so old. Even I get annoyed by the ADHD TikTokers. Sorry, I didn't say that.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the positive to take away from all this, and thank you everyone for your questions and contributions, is that we're talking about it and being more understanding and trying to help people who are struggling. So I'd like to say thank you so much, Shappy, for coming and speaking to us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much. Thanks for all your questions. And thank you very much. You've been lovely.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.